history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some incredible stories waiting to be told, some valuable lessons waiting for us to learn, and sometimes all it takes is a little time. Time to ask a few questions, to listen, at times in amazement to circumstances and adventures that it can be hard for us to imagine. The idea here is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And every time we do that, we end up learning and growing from it. We're educated, we're entertained, we are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation, which really can become even more powerful when there's somewhere you can go to see, to touch, to feel the history firsthand. Over the course of this next hour, we're going to talk about one of those opportunities, a traveling exhibit that is only heading to 10 cities around the country. It started out in Oregon's capital city last summer. If you're listening today on KYKN in Salem, maybe you got to visit the exhibit. I first got to experience it in Hawaii's capital city in November with some special touches illustrating the impact in Honolulu and Oahu. In the future, it'll be in Illinois, in Ohio, in Minnesota. If you're listening on KIV in Albuquerque, you'll be getting a New Mexico version of the exhibit sometime in 2019. If you're hearing us on KION in Monterey, California, it's coming your way in fall 2018. But between now and the first weekend in February, it's in a spot you probably wouldn't expect. And I really hope that those of you listening on stations in Fresno, in Bakersfield, in Modesto, San Luis Obispo, even those of you down in San Diego in that area, that you'll consider a trip to Kingsburg, California in the San Joaquin Valley to see the free, yes, I said free, exhibit called Communities of Compassion and Courage. We're going to hear from a few different voices today who put this powerful exhibit in perspective, and the topic is something that if you're a longtime listener to Hometown Heroes, hopefully you've got a little background on. Some of the most powerful stories we've heard here have come from Nisei veterans of World War II, American-born soldiers of Japanese ancestry who fought for the very country that was detaining their families behind barbed wire. 120,000 Japanese Americans living on the West Coast were forced in the wake of President Franklin D. Roosevelt's Executive Order 9066 into internment camps further inland. In many cases, they lost everything they had. In some inspiring examples, their families' possessions or land were held for them by kind-hearted neighbors who returned it to them after the war. We've heard from quite a few Nisei veterans over the years, including many from the legendary 442nd Regimental Combat Team. You've probably even heard it described as World War II's most decorated unit. Right after all Nisei veterans were honored with the Congressional Gold Medal in 2011, Bob Yano shared his story on Hometown Heroes. It's episode number 186 at hometownheroesradio.com if you want to hear that entire conversation. Mr. Yano is one of the veterans whose stories are presented as part of this traveling exhibit launched by the Go for Broke National Education Center. We're going to hear how Bob feels about this exhibit coming to his hometown in a bit, but inside of a case of his World War II memorabilia in Kingsburg is a very unique artifact that he described for us in his original appearance on Hometown Heroes. His mom had been visiting relatives in Hiroshima, Japan when the attack on Pearl Harbor happened. As the rest of his family headed to the Gila River internment camp in Arizona, he had no idea what had become of her. But before he left that camp to join the 442, he received a very special gift.
This is what you call in Japanese a sending buddy. Sending buddy means a thousand. Thousand dots on here. Each dot is put by a lady.
Uh-huh.
And if you wear this around your waist, never take it off, that you will survive the war and come back. So while I was in Gila camp, before I was going overseas, a lady came up to me and says, I want you to have this. I want you to wear it. Take it. So I know that your mom isn't here. So I had all these ladies put these dots on for you. And I took it, and I wore it around my waist. And it's unbelievable, but it was around my waist. You couldn't tell whether it was white, blue, black, or what. It reminds me of camp. The most regret I have now, and after all that, is not remembering that lady that gave it to me. And I know she meant it from the bottom of her heart because I'm sure she had kids of her own too, but she brought it to me thinking that, well, this would bring me home. She went around the whole camp. You can take 1,000 dot, that's a lot of women to put, each one put a dot. Mm-hmm. Although there was 6,000 people in there, but that still takes a lot of people to go around and get this dot.
That was with you in the Vosges Mountains and everywhere you were with the 442nd.
All the way, way over and all the way back, up in the mountains, down the mountains, wherever.
That special sash was with him then. It's on display now for you to go see in Kingsburg. If you've heard Bob's story, you know he never would see his mother again. She passed away in Japan during the war. We're going to hear from now nearly 94-year-old Bob Yano in a bit. But for now, let's learn more about this Communities of Compassion and Courage exhibit from its curator, Dave Meyer.
For the last year, we have been working on, with Go for Broke, having input into the overall exhibition. And then we've also been ferreting out the local stories, which are shown in the exhibition, primarily about 7 individual families and how they fared with the internment, but also featuring information about the community as a whole, as it was affected by the internment and by the war in general.
And I want to ask you about what you've learned in that process and what you hope people learn from coming to this exhibit. But just put your Kingsburg hat on for a second. And what does this mean for this community? Because I know that Kingsburg has an Olympic gold medalist in Rafer Johnson, you can claim, and his brother Jimmy Johnson in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And I think you have the only Swedish coffee pot water tower in America. But to be one of only 10 cities in the country, what other people from the outside would say, little old Kingsburg, and you're one of 10 cities in the whole country that get this exhibit. How significant is that?
Well, I think it's huge for a number of different reasons. For one thing, we have brought in quite a few people from as far away as that I know of, San Diego to Northern California. They've come to Kingsburg, a community that they may never have known even existed. Just as I learned from my research, I'm hoping that we can transfer some of that information to the larger population about how important the Japanese Americans were to the early 20th century development of the San Joaquin Valley agriculture. I'm not sure that it's a story that is as well known as it should be. It certainly wasn't well known to me. And as I stated in the exhibit, in 1940, Kingsburg had 1,504 inhabitants, and we don't have any breakdown of the ethnicity. But we do know that it's generally accepted that in the early 1900s, Kingsburg was 90% or more Swedish. And so now we see this influx of Japanese Americans, most of whom were involved in agriculture because they came over not having language skills and not having any particular business or other commercial skills. So the avenues of economic activity open to them was pretty limited, and many, many of them became farm laborers and started out with the most humble beginnings, with no language skills and virtually no money. And in many cases, they were able to build upon that, save money, bring over brides from Japan, in some cases start up businesses, and in other cases buy some small farms and become fully integrated into the community until, of course, 1940.
Well, yeah, in just a few decades, they have all this momentum going. And then Pearl Harbor happened, and then Executive Order 9066, and now all of a sudden, they're not wanted here anymore. They're ostracized. And that's the bigger picture, but it sounds like, and in looking through your exhibit, you found not only the effects of that greater exclusion, but you saw some exceptions to that rule, where some compassion emerged from that landscape. What are the things that really surprised you or amazed you when you did that research?
That's a double-edged sword. It worked in two ways. I did ask people who were alive at the time if there was any protest to the 9066 coming out and taking all of these people away against their will. And from what I've been able to ascertain, there was very little in the way of protest. There may have been individual sentiments thinking that, gosh, this isn't the right thing to do. but there wasn't any much verbalization. That's the one side of it. The other side that we've emphasized quite a bit in telling some of the local stories is how these people were able to come back after the war and get back into whatever they had when they left, how the Mizutani's were able to get back in their, into their market, and how the farmers such as the Setos and the Llanos and the Andos and Izakis were able to get back onto their farms. And it was mostly by the help of good citizens who either bought their land for a token amount, such as a dollar, and then resold it back to them when they returned for that same dollar, or who leased it, took care of the land, farmed it, or whatever, and then simply gave it back when the original owners returned.
Is there an element to this exhibit, piece of it? Because it is distinctly Kingsburg. This is a traveling exhibit. Some of the elements remain the same or similar, and I saw some of this in Honolulu at the debut of it there. But parts of it are distinctly Kingsburg. You mentioned the families whose stories are told there, and you get that context, and you see history, the history of Kingsburg, through this lens. Did you have any idea of how integral the Japanese-American community was to the history of this city?
No, I didn't.
And how long have you lived here?
I came to Kingsburg in 1977, although my wife is the third generation Kingsburg citizen, and I don't think she had any better clue than I did, having come here in 1977. The influences that used to exist is largely been hidden because the Japanese grocery stores are gone. The Buddhist church that existed prior to 1940 was burnt down during the war. It has been rebuilt in a different location, so there is that influence. But the population, I am pretty well convinced, has declined considerably, and I base that on the fact that if we go to our high school pictures and we look at the graduates of Kingsburg High, 1940, you will be at almost 20% of the graduating class was made up of Japanese American citizens. And then you go to 1943, say, after the Executive Order 9066 was out and after there had been time to remove everybody. And of course, there are no Japanese Americans left in that class. So if you proceed from that time forward into late 1940s, 1950s, you will see that the level of Japanese American students is never returned to that 20% mark. And that would indicate to me that we lost a part of that population that never returned to Kingsburg.
So you're representing over 100 years of history. But it sounds like you're saying that until you took this project on, you didn't realize that you can't tell the history of Kingsburg without the contributions of the Japanese American community.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. And we received some of the information from a fellow named Mats Ando. And Mats, in his later years, was a strawberry farmer. Believe it or not, when the first strawberries came in every year, the people would mob the place, and he'd have to put a sign out after they'd sell out very quickly because they come in slowly, and over a period of time when they're harvested, he was known far and wide for that. But he was also really helpful, and by the way, he has passed away. The interviews that we have of him are from earlier years, but he talked about the early agriculture, and he felt that the Japanese Americans were vital in terms of the development of San Joaquin Valley agriculture because they did a lot of the tree plantings, they did a lot of the early agriculture in terms of one thing that was very big was watermelons. At one time, watermelons were huge in this area, and the Japanese Americans were a large part of the producers of watermelons. And in fact, at one point, they even formed an organization because they felt they were not getting fair prices from the shippers. So they formed a coalition, which after World War II just fell apart, but they moved into other parts of agriculture. But he felt that they were an integral part of the agricultural development of the San Joaquin Valley in general and the Kingsburg area in specific.
So that's an example of some history, some broader history of the whole area that because of Pearl Harbor and 9066 was erased or forgotten. and would have been forgotten if not for projects like this that kind of scribble that back in and teach all of us and maybe add a little more perspective to how egregious it was to lock all these people up. And I don't want to put those words in your mouth. When you think about all the people that are going to come through here and see this in your hometown, what do you hope they get from it? What do you hope their takeaway is when they leave here?
I just like them to think about a number of things, one of which is, can something like this happen again? Many people would say, well, the internment camps or concentration camps, depending on what terminology you prefer to use, they were humane. We didn't torture people. We didn't starve people. We didn't beat people, so on and so forth. And they put that in reference to the brutalization that occurred in other theaters of war. The Japanese soldiers treated some of our soldiers brutally, then the German. All of these things happen in war, but they're not really comparable. You can't equate the two because these were, in many cases, American citizens that were supposed to have the protections of the U.S. Constitution, and those protections were just taken away with one executive order. And if you think about that, that's kind of a frightening thing that that can happen.
And this certainly highlights that. And I look over there at Bob Yano, almost 94 years old, using his cane, wearing his 442 hat, and looking at his memorabilia from the war in his hometown on this exhibit that so many people are going to see. Have you ever looked at him or someone like him, knowing what he went through, and said, boy, how would I have handled that if I were in that situation?
I thought of it many, many times, and I have to say that I would not have handled it as well. I would not have responded as positively as he did. I probably would have been angry and bitter, and I don't think that's would be the exception. I think Bob is the exception, and many of the people who were in the camps are the exception, because they have seemingly moved on and gotten over it. And if you think about it, especially the people that lost their farms, their businesses, or whatever in the war, they have a right to be angry about it. And yet they seem to have been able to go move on and get over that. And I admire that tremendously.
So that's a powerful example for the rest of us. And speaking of Bob, you have an exhibit here, an element to this display. That's all stuff of his uniform from the war, things he carried with him, including that hand-sewn wrap around his body that was meant for protection. Is there a part of his display that impresses you the most or that you get the most satisfaction out of?
Oh, yeah. The sensibari, which is the sash you refer to. The story is absolutely fascinating about that. And I have to say, because it has such tremendous personal value to his family, we were kind of hesitant about putting it even in a locked cabinet in this display, because if something should happen to it, it would be irreplaceable. And he took that with him, and he wore it the entire time he was in Europe fighting the war. And to me, that's just an amazing, amazing artifact that he's generously loaned us to show. And I really wish people would understand the significance of something like that.
Well, they certainly will if they come out and see it in person here in Kingsburg. Before we take this break, Dave, maybe you can share those details for folks who are listening right now and say, yeah, I want to experience this free traveling exhibit.
Kingsburg Historical Park, and it will be open from Wednesday through Sunday from 9 o'clock until 5 o'clock each of those days. We'll be closed Monday and Tuesday. However, if we had a special tour that needed some special arrangements, we're certainly open to doing whatever we need to do to bring in the public.
Sounds like a good idea for teachers within a few hours' drive of Kingsburg. The Gopher Broke National Education Center even has some classroom packets tailored to the exhibit. Again, it's in Kingsburg, California through February 4th, and I have that information linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. When we come back, we'll hear how Nisei veteran Bob Yano feels about having this national tour stop in his hometown. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.